and recognize that it has fulfilled its purpose, and recognize the demographic shifts that are happening. And certainly I don't feel that I should or will receive a longevity bonus when my time comes. And what I would like to do is be a part of finding an acceptable solution to the pay gap.
Representative McClain.
I have a question on the bill, and I don't know, Commissioner Nocera, whether you can answer it. But this bill, the original bill, Senate Bill 8, what happens to a person who has put in monies into the annuity account and that person, that elder, dies after the age of 65? What would happen to the monies that...
The value?
The
value that's been put into the account? Without being an opinion, I'm sure we have some people who would know that. I would presume that it would go to the estate of the person, because that annuity would be held in the name of the person. So it would actually, any contributions made and interest earned would transfer to the estate of the individual. It wouldn't be in the name of the state, if that's your concern.
Okay. The other question that I have, it's on Section 8 on page 3, the emergency withdrawals. The only way that a person could withdraw from the annuity is for an unforeseeable emergency by regulation. I don't understand the reason for this area, because if a person is putting a permanent fund dividend, their cash money, in there, the only way that they can withdraw it is through an emergency by regulation. But it's their own money. And so I wonder, how is that addressed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McClain, it does, it goes with the terms and conditions of most annuities, which is that it is designed as a retirement income or a social security type program. And like IRAs or other annuity programs or vehicles, it's designed to be held in trust, and that the only way one can have access, it's upon penalty. There might be some penalty provision for early withdrawal of the program. What was envisioned in terms of emergencies is poses some difficulty from us if we were entrusted with the administration of this program, which I'm hopeful won't be the case, frankly. But if we are entrusted with that program, it's going to be extremely difficult to make those determinations. It is also, one of the things that went into the preparation of our fiscal note was having to make some rather large assumptions about the running of the program. These kinds of processes and provisions for qualifying the terms and conditions in emergency things are extremely expensive to administer, because you have to put in, obviously, appeal processes, you have to have a hearing, you have to, so if someone is turned down for emergency access to their funds, we have to have some sort of an appeal process and hearing process associated with that. Obviously, what might be construed as an emergency to you would not be for me. Those are some of the sticky parts of this legislation that would be difficult to administer and certainly warrants some serious consideration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Chung.
If we were to have an annuity program and that the state was going to have and be responsible for, it makes sense for us to allow for the administrative cost of that program to be taken out of whatever the annuity amounts were, would it not?
Mr. Chairman, that's how the retirement and benefit programs that we have for state employees, for example, are handled, that it is taken out of the contributions themselves, and I think absolutely that that's an appropriate way. I don't, I don't think that it would be, so I think we have to factor that in, not only the cost to the program, but also to, in order to make it cost effective. I don't see that this would be something that would be unlike other retirement and benefit programs that we currently manage.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Commissioner, when this particular law was first put on the books, memory serves me correctly, at the time, it was $25 a month, and it was for people that had been here 25 years or more and were true pioneers, and I think that's the word, the longevity bonus. Is there any way that we could determine how many of the people that were pioneers at the time? Because certainly I don't believe that people that have been here for a short period of time can in any way be considered pioneers. And that any of those people are still alive?
Still alive?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Ms. Chair, I...
They look it. I think it would be...
I'd like to know how many of them are still alive.
I think
alive,
it would be fair to say that a good portion of the people who are receiving longevity bonus checks are still alive and still receiving it. What proportion of the recipients are pioneers is an interesting question. Dennis here? Oh, do we know that?
Or older?
No, not necessarily. But I think that,
yeah,
you know.
Well, I know, for example, Bob Atwood and a few of those people are still alive. I know that.
Anyone who lived in Alaska prior to statehood and is 65 or older now is eligible.
I understand that, but that's not my point. The point was that. That when times were really tough here and there were no retirement systems and that was the reason why this program came into existence, the true pioneers who had contributed much to the state. And then, of course, we deviated immensely from that concept. And I feel that it is really fair for the people that were true pioneers to be part of the system. And I have a real serious problem trying to carry this program on it as it has been for everybody that's just coming to the state. And I know, for example, last year that 44% of the people that signed up for the permanent fund dividend are foreign aliens. An awful lot of those are also recipients of the permanent longevity bonus. And this is becoming quite a problem for us. And I think the concept that the House Finance Committee came up with, transferring it to the permanent fund earnings and phasing it out through the year, whatever it was would take care of the pioneers that were here. And I guess I'm just seeking your thoughts on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that the people who are in the program today are those for whom it was originally intended. I think that we have to look for some sort of a phase out. I think that it's also realistic. Somebody's going to have to translate this to me. I also think that it's realistic that there are those people who have lived in Alaska who are, say, 60 years old, who have had an anticipation of receiving this, and that some accommodation in this phase out should be made for them because they have accepted that. But I think beyond that, it's just unrealistic to think that we can continue the program. One of the comments, since you mentioned the phase out of the Finance Committee, the proposal that was made, that I might mention is that I think in the out years, in the final year of phase out, the payments would be something like $20 a month that would go out to some 44,000 participants. I would certainly encourage you or urge you to take another look at that, to administer a program like that for $20 checks. It seems to me that we could tighten that up, and phase it out with the minimum. And certainly in a 14-year out, what is $20 going to mean in terms of actual cash value? That I would encourage you to drop it after perhaps $100, where anything beyond that, the cost associated with the distribution of the money would almost be offset any value to the recipient. So I would ask you to take another look at that schedule. Alaska Longevity Bonus Age Breakdown. Oh, I see. There are, between the ages of 65 and 60, we can distribute this if you have an interest in, between the ages of 65 and, oh, thank you, 65 and 69, in 1990 there were 8,500 participants, which is 42%. So 42% of the participants are under age 70. 28% are between 70 and 75. 17% are between 75 and 80, 8% to 85, 3.5% to 90, and to 95, there is 1%. So that gives you a sense of...
So the true pioneers there that were there at the time of the program is a very small percentage of what we're paying out.
Up 28.
That actually, depends how you read it.
Actually, the ones maybe who were originally on the program, I'm sure it's a very small percentage. We don't have statistics, do we, to say how many of them were, how many
moved
people
in.
Were currently on the program or here prior to 1959?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that was what Dennis DeWitt, who's the division director, I think that we can go back and take some looks and maybe come to some conclusions on that. You know, demographically, we have the permanent fund records, so we know how many people are receiving that check for the first time. We could probably make some calculations and see what we can come up with, but I think we can get back to you on some specifics, some conclusions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like, if you could come up with some specifics, to be very specific, I would like to know, for example, the people in the last, let's say, 5 years,
mm-hmm.
how long they've lived in Alaska, and those that have lived here less than a year.
I think about 20 or 30 percent.
I don't know, Ms. Chemerickson Barnes, if we, as part of the application process, after the lawsuit, I'm not sure that we could or did ask for length of residency, because it was we were no longer able to use that as a criteria for determination. So we didn't, after the lawsuit, we didn't keep those records. But we'll sure dig in. And
Mr. Chairman,
I know what you're looking for. We can see what we can find.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me that if we can ask that question on the permanent fund dividend, that we could ask that question to people who are, as long as you didn't deny it based upon that question, how long they've lived in Alaska. Because personally, I think that's what's killing the program.
We'll be happy to look into that, see what we can dig up for you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a point as far as your feeling on constitutionality or legality on something of this nature that would be sort of a hybrid between the two bills,
mm-hmm.
that would lock present recipients into 250 for the remainder of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Next year, anyone that was 65 or over and become eligible on the other eligibility requirements, namely residency,
mm-hmm.
would receive $230 a month for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
The following year, they were 65 or over and met the 1 year residency, would receive $210 a month and for the rest of their life. In other words, no matter, they had to meet all the eligibility requirements for each step down, including residency, to get that reduced amount for the rest of their life. That would avoid the high cost of an annuity, allow them to utilize the permanent fund, protect the people presently in there that have their lifestyle and fixed income built into 250, but still would step it down at $5 to $6 million a year, roughly, until it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
No, but that's what I'd like to know, if we could get a legal opinion on something like that, because that would drive it down and extinguish the program, but would not put any undue financial burden on present recipients who are on fixed income, but would allow people in the future to we build that in, that reduction into their, anyone coming into the state at age 70 and met the 1 year would be eligible for the, whatever lower amount was available at that time for everybody.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, the criteria is age. So as Representative Ulmer mentioned earlier...
The present criteria is age and 1 year residency.
Right, well, I mean, but even with those criteria, even through a step-down program, it's not the year you enter the program, but it is the age you are that would determine the amount that you receive. So if my mother, my 75-year-old mother, moves up here and establishes residency, she would come in at the level all 75-year-old people are receiving.
That's what I'd like. Yes. I don't think that was the true decision on the longevity bonus. I think the true decision was primarily based on being a resident of the state at the time of statehood.
Right.
I think that was what caused it to go gunny sack.
It was 25 years.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to look into that. And I was just going to say the other portion of this in terms of reaching this compromise is that certainly it would be no problem for us to work with the Department of Revenue and add the third component to this, which would be to provide for a checkoff on the permanent fund check for an annuity, perhaps a choice of one of three annuities that could be made available in the private sector through some sort of a checkoff. So, I mean, it would make it easier for people who wish to participate in an annuity program to do that. If that continues to be a priority of the seniors, I think that adding that third component would be a fine compromise. And avoiding the perpetuity of setting up another bureaucratic structure to administer a program that is a true cost to the program.
It might be better to just send out a brochure with everybody's permanent fund dividend that shows what annuities are available through private companies, because I guess I just feel that it ought to be an individual's responsibility rather than a state responsibility, and the state just doesn't have the funds anymore to assume responsibility that we can't pay for.
Okay. That'd be
Representative Ulmer.
Just a real quick question about the rate of growth of the program. I'm looking at several attachments for SB 8 that project the number of qualified recipients from this day forward. And it looks like the numbers only assume about 1,100 people per year being added.
Right.
And I think that probably understates the rate of growth the program has experienced. I guess I should have asked this question of Paula or someone else, but what, over the last few years, can you tell me what the percentage increase in number of eligible recipients has been?
I can't, but I imagine Dennis DeWitt can.
About 10%.
Do you have that available?
It's about 10% per year.
Yeah, I think it would probably be fair to say that there's probably a percentage. It's more percentage-driven, percentage of the population, so consequently it arithmetically goes up. But maybe we can...
Okay, well,
Sure, I thought he might have it on...
Because a number of projections of what the various alternatives of SBA would cost the state are apparently based on assumptions of eligible recipients that understate the rate of growth of the senior population. I'd just like to get those numbers clarified. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Barnes and then Larson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to the remark made by the commissioner. If her 75-year-old mother came up here, she would go in at the point that that age group went in. But that, I think, and it's the part that a problem that I have with the program, because if I chose to bring my mother up here to live with me, I'd like to be able to do that, but number one, I couldn't take care of her. but number two, she didn't do anything to earn that longevity bonus. She wasn't a pioneer. She hasn't been here living or working, and I think that that's the problem with the program. No contribution except the fact that she's my mother. Just to have a real serious problem with that.
You know, I think we can all agree that that's what the problem with the program is, that it's no longer the program that it was initially designed to be. And, you know, if it were within my power to wave a wand and take it back, I assure you that we would. Regrettably, a small item called the Constitution that prevents us from doing that.
Yes, I have two questions again. The first one on the annuity program, would that be a defined benefit? In other words, if the state administers it and the interest earnings weren't such that the state would then still be legally responsible to fund whatever was necessary to make up the difference between the 250 and the declining bonus?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, frankly, it's unclear to me. In the ballot proposition that was put forth in 1985, it appears that for the first 14 years there would be a defined benefit, and that is that that's where the additional cost comes in, that recipients would, in fact, coming into the program, would be guaranteed $250 a year, which would be offset by whatever contribution would be made from the annuity. Obviously, the annuity and the value of the annuity and the benefit that which is derived from the annuity is based on the amount of the contribution that goes in each year. And, you know, there's also the consideration that we can't ignore that any future use of permanent fund dividends could be this is a consideration in terms of making a long-term commitment to fund annuities through the contribution of these of dividends, which may or may not be there in the future. So we would be putting. So the short answer to your question is, as I understand it, for the first 14 years, there is a defined benefit of $250 as it was envisioned on the 1985 proposition. Whether or not that's still, you know, a part of the consideration, I would defer to Senator Petula's staff.
Ask my second question and beg your leeway, Mr. Chairman, because they're going to be talking about Senate Bill 8 as it came over from the Senate. But would this be a win-win situation where we'd simply say that within the original bill we would adopt the longevity bonus as it declines, and that we would allow everyone, both the present and the future senior citizens, to keep their permanent fund dividend check? Basically, what this would do then is, over a period of that number of years, do away with the longevity bonus.
Mm-hmm.
But by allowing everyone to keep their permanent fund dividend check, we would give them the individual option of establishing their own annuity or not, which means over the period of time, those who individually decided to invest their permanent fund dividend check would receive interest earnings of $250 a month or more. Whereas those who wanted to spend their money immediately would have access to it and could spend it on whatever they wanted. So I guess what I'm saying is that, can we meet everyone's objective, that those who want to be responsible and invest their money, that it would ensure that they would have a longevity bonus, and meet the state's objective in that the program would eventually be phased out? And even during the phase-out period, we could consider the alternate source of funding from the general fund to some other source of funding, whether it be the earnings reserve or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Blocks, let me make sure I have this. I have this. Your scenario clear. Current recipients would have the 250 phased out, or are we talking about grandfathering in the people who are currently.
No, they would have to use their permanent fund dividends as everyone else would in order to make up the difference. So current 65-year-olds would get to keep their permanent fund dividend check, but they'd also would be subject to the declining bonus.
As a practical matter, Mr. Larson, I don't think you would get the support of that constituency, and I think that as a practical matter, it would probably kill the bill.
It might be a better alternative to the present seniors to say, well, we're willing to invest our permanent fund dividend in order to protect our future longevity bonus, because if we don't do something in light of current state revenues, every year, whether it's a bonus program or not, it's going to be a threat. And I'm just thinking of a way to secure the future for the seniors.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, you know, I think that it would be most appropriate to pose that question to the senior citizens. I think it would be presumptuous for me to answer that on their behalf. But I don't think that we should discount any option.
Thank you.
If we did a 1% income tax, we could afford to pay for this.
Yeah.
Well, Representative Copeland.
I don't think that's going to
happen. I'm glad it wasn't a question.
Section 2, the annuity credit selection applies to dividends beginning after December 31st, 92. And a Section 9 says... A person who is 65 after honor before January 1, 94 is entitled to a full longevity bonus without reduction. Well, between those two dates is 1993. And does that mean that a person who becomes 65 during 1993 has to make a permanent fund annuity selection for that 1 year? Since there's a year that in there you're supposed to make selection for an annuity after December 31st. And the guarantee applies to people who were 65 on or before 94. Mm-hmm. Well, that means somebody who became 65 during 93 is guaranteed that. But on the other hand, during that same year, he's supposed to make a selection on the annuity credit the way I read the bill. Section 9 and 11, are they consistent with one another, or is there...
Mr. Chairman,
shouldn't that both happen the same year?
Yeah. At the risk of being evasive, we didn't write this bill. This wasn't our bill. Maybe whoever did the drafting on it might be able to answer you.
Well, I think some of the dates have been changed. I'm not sure if people looked at the consistency of that. I'm just wondering.
We have a couple other people who I'd like to give an opportunity to testify today. Representative Sharps?
Just one question. To the commissioner, if you think there was constitutional problems in the step down and utilizing total eligibility for entering the plan in future years, including the year's residency, no matter what the age, as long as they're 65 or older, what about the constitutionality of really biting the bullet and saying, we're out of this program, we're grandfathering everybody in at $250 a month and after December 31st, no more new applicants. Is that legal?
Sure.
Even though people would come in the state older than 65 after that would not be eligible. I mean,
we're saying
we're out of the business. We're grandfathering in everybody that's here. We're out of the business.
Sharp, I think you have to have a residency requirement. Anybody who meets that residency requirement is entitled to that. Otherwise, you can't discriminate. So unless you could extend the residency requirements, which we've already tried to do a number of times, anybody who came up who was of the age, wherever you started stair-stepping it, and met the residency requirement would be eligible. That's
It's the age provision that everybody who is 63 must receive the same amount. Everyone who is 70 must receive the same amount. That each class, however it is that you provide for it, each class that you establish must receive the same benefit. And the class with regard to this program, as I understand it, is the age, as well as the once they've met the residency requirement.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I do have the entry into the program, and I'll be happy to make copies and distribute it to the committee for you.
Carolyn Bird.
That's the part I have. Someone comes up and they get $250 a month.
My name is Carolyn Berg, and I've been I'm a United States citizen, and I've been a resident of Juneau for 38 years. This is a very popular bill because it was voted on by all of the people, the young and the old, and passed. So it's popular. It's really a popular, and I wish we could get some kind of a annuity bill out because this is what the people want. And I think if you voted for it today, the same thing would happen. And I was very excited about it. I lobbied for this for the Pioneers of Alaska here in 1984 or 85 when it was last put in. And it passed except for the veto. So I do hope that, I think it's a good because we're using our Visa cards and other cards today and spending all our money, spending more than we should. And I think the people of Alaska would welcome a little discipline in putting some money into an annuity so that the banks, for instance, would have a little money to deal with. And it would be a good discipline to save money. When I was raised, I saved money, and I still save money. It's part of me. But now, today, I don't even have a Visa card because I don't believe in them. I think people would love to have a chance to put money into something that they could look forward to later, and they just don't have the discipline now to do that unless somebody asks them to do it or unless it's a regulation. So I think this would be good to have somebody put them into a program like this. Now, Governor Hickel said he would sign it, and that's good. And this bill, an annuity, would bring votes for every one of you. Because the people really want it. So I think someplace there's a chance for an annuity bill for Alaska, and I think we would be really wise to sit down and try to figure out something that would make people save money. I wouldn't mind putting some of the money into a special account if I knew I were getting something later on. For instance, the Pioneers of Alaska have to be here 30 years before they become a pioneer. And I'm a pioneer. Mr. Sharp's a pioneer. And quite a few other people, and all those people back of me, I'm sure are pioneers. But I just want to point out to you that it's a very good program, a very good thing to think about politically and for the good reason that people need discipline in saving these days. Thank you.
Okay, one question. It's it's 30-year requirement to be a Pioneer?
Yes, yeah. you have to be in Alaska, a resident of Alaska for 30 years before you even can become a Pioneer.
You're a Pioneer.
And I really feel that they should. I really feel that they should flag these people that are pioneers. Put a flag on them because they're real special people. They have property and they have helped to build up airfields and other things, you know, in Alaska. And I think they should be rewarded for something like that. Thank you.
I think we've probably got at least seven pioneers more sitting at this table here, haven't we?
Any other questions?
I've been here all but 3 years in my life.
Okay, maybe thank you.
Something more than 30.
Joe Alter.
Mr. Chairman, while Joe's coming to the table, I'll tell you one idea that did occur to me after I heard Mrs. Berg's presentation is maybe we could just make a large cash grant to the Pioneers of Alaska and allow the Pioneers of Alaska to make the distribution of the longevity bonus and skip the problem that the case in 1982 created for us, and maybe we could go back to where we once were.
Contract it out.
Yeah, contract it out, yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Amos Joe Alter. I live here in Juneau, and I'm speaking today in favor of Senate Bill 8 and representing the American Association of Retired Persons. As I said, I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 8, the concepts involved in it, and as amended by State Affairs. I speak in favor of it based on these, what I believe to be facts, that govern all of us. I think possibly each of us has a similar concern. I think we're all concerned about being able to make both ends meet with a general fund that is not as well sugared as it used to be. And when I say all of us, I don't think that is necessarily confined to legislators. I think it's confined to the total population, with few exceptions. Another assumption that I make is that I believe that we do not discredit or discount the value of any segment of our society, whether they're babes in wrinkled wrappers or people working to make a living. Babes in diapers or seniors in wrinkled wrappers, I should say. I think we hold each segment of society to have a value, and I think we consider that rich mix or blend of Alaska age groups to have been greatly enhanced by such things as the longevity bonus. Just like any other business in Alaska, since the longevity bonus and other programs have subsidized people in their retirement years in Alaska, they have come. They're here. And they're growing, as you have heard, in numbers. Based on those assumptions, then, that we're all seeking a common goal, that we do consider that there is some value in a blend of age groups in society, and recognizing that subsidy is a way of life. Witness, you subsidize timber industry. We subsidize many industries. We subsidize mining. We subsidize tourism. We subsidize cities. I'm not asking you to debate the appropriateness of subsidy. Neither am I asking you as a representative of AARP to debate with me the precise method in which the concepts of Senate Bill 8 are implemented. But I would request you, please, to work with the senior citizens as we seek to attain a common goal of how to do things rather than how not to do them. I believe it's a well-established record of that subsidy pays off. the senior business community, and I think perhaps each of you maybe have received some information on what the longevity bonus means in your election district. But I would say it's a billion-dollar industry in Alaska that touches every corner of Alaska. It isn't an industry which brings a few dollars in during a brief period in the year, mostly siphoned off out of state. It's an industry that passes dollars to the grocer in any village in Alaska. In summary, I think we're all in this together. We wish to work with you. Please help us to work with you to figure out how to do something rather than how not to do something. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Alter. Representative Larson.
Could you just speak briefly on your concept of a state-sponsored annuity versus a individual annuity and how you feel on that?
I am speaking for the American Association of Retired Persons, and their position is that they support the State Affairs amended Senate Bill 8 of Senator Katulis. I do not know all of the thinking that went into this position, but I believe it's a position that is represented by at least our statistically correct report from our 39,000 members.
See, the only, the two areas, as I see in the state affairs version, is the idea of whether you should have a state annuity or an individual annuity. And then the second portion is the declining longevity bonus. And as I suggested before, if there were provisions in which everyone would keep the permanent fund dividend check, and whether you had a state-sponsored annuity or a private, I guess it wouldn't make any difference. But you folks do support, then, the declining longevity bonus.
Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Larson, yes, we support the declining program that was set forth in Senate Bill 8. I think that was a great contribution, and I might say an accommodation on the part of seniors, who some said, we want it now and forever, just as it is. And through this accommodation that's offered in Senate Bill 8, which provides for a phase-out of the program gradually, I think the seniors have accommodated the need.
Then for myself, I can see the only conflict that remains is whether we should have one group who gets their permanent fund dividend and one group who don't, or whether they both should or they both shouldn't.
As I stated earlier, I would not presume to be an authority to work out the details. I am not familiar with that. I only seek your support with us in trying to accommodate and implement the concepts of Senate Bill 8 state with, as amended in state affairs.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Okay, that's all the people that I have signed up to testify on the bill today. We're going to hold Senate Bill 8 over in committee. We're going to meet tomorrow. First of all, I want to assign Senate Bill 35, which is use of rented property and law violations, to a subcommittee, Representative Brown, Chair, Representative Kopanen, and Representative Barnes.
That's for you.
Also, all of the bills that we have remaining on the calendar today will be held over until tomorrow. And the Finance Committee will meet at 9 o'clock in the morning.
I can't believe it. Getting off early today. The boss is letting us off.
Employer outside the door.
First bill will take up is Senate Bill 394, Senator Collins. We also have Representative Sharp and Boyer. We do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to have Senate Bill 394 heard. I know you have a lot of bills on your agenda. I will be brief, as there are two other people to testify who can give you some information on the program in particular. Senate Bill 394 creates the Alaska School Counseling Program grant fund consisting of legislative appropriations and public and private donations. SB 394 authorizes the Department of Education to make grants to the fund to school districts for a counseling program in grades K through 12. SB 394 is exactly the bill that we had last year, a Senate Bill 195, which was vetoed by the governor. I guess it was his concern that this would usurp the authority of the local school boards, and I think since then he's learned that is not the case. The local schools are supportive of the program. I believe that Senate Bill 394 will help in extending the current counseling programs that we currently have. It basically will positively impact the rural areas that do not have the resources to have the counseling programs that we have in Anchorage and in the urban areas. So with that, I will answer any questions that you may have and request that we have a couple people here to testify, and if you have any questions on the program itself, they will answer them for you.
As Senator Collins, I have a question. That is that the fiscal note this year appears to be about $500,000 higher than the fiscal note last year, and it would be my intention at least to support the lower fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year's bill did have a lower fiscal note. This year, when it went before the Senate Finance Committee, the co-chair of finance from the Mat Valley was the individual who made the motion for that increased funding, and so you can discuss that with him.
Perhaps the co-chair of Senate Finance from the Matsu Valley just doesn't understand that we have a fiscal crisis. Are there questions for Senator Collins? Thank you, Senator. Drew Alexander.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Drew Alexander, and I'm an assistant principal at Juno Douglas High School. And, Southeast Alaska is represented on the Alaska School Counselors Association Executive Board. Prior to becoming an administrator, I was a counselor in the Juno schools for 2 years and also served as a counselor in the North Slope for several years. I will be brief. I want to point out some information that was released in the State of Adolescent Health in Alaska survey that was done, actually released 2 years ago in this coming May. And in that survey, it said that the survey of 5,000 students in our schools, that 1 in 6 Alaskan students reported they had attempted suicide, and that 25% of the female respondents and 8% of all the male respondents in the survey reported sexual abuse, that 75% of females and 67% of males reported being sexually active by their senior year. 20% of the state teenage girls had been pregnant, and more than 1 in 4 of that number had been pregnant multiple times. That nearly half of the high school age males and a third of the high school age females report drinking and driving. 1 in 10 students surveyed reported daily or weekly use of marijuana. That nearly 40% of all the youth had been involved in violent behaviors, and between 15 and 25% of Alaskan youth had participated in illegal activities such as vandalism, shoplifting, and stealing from home. It's because of survey results such as this that we are enthusiastically behind Senator Collins' bill. We support her efforts. We feel like this program will help create a new breed of counselors within the state. Counselors that are trained to work with the most troubled youth, providing workable, realistic solutions to overcome these problems. The Juno schools have been involved in the Alaska School Counseling Program for 2 years. The first year is a self-evaluation of exactly where you are as far as counseling goes. And through this assessment, you involve parents, teachers, students, administration, community members, and then you decide where you want to go. And the second year, which we're in right now, we're actually implementing a counseling curriculum that does address some of these concerns. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have about the program.
A question from Mr. Alexander? Thank you. Thank you. Could you address the fiscal note?
Senator Copen.
We have two fiscal notes. One of them is fairly high. But even if we were able to afford the higher one, would the program be able to make a six-fold expansion or five-fold expansion in one year?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Would the program be able to expand that rapidly from roughly 100,000 a year to 600,000 a year?
The $500,000 additional that Senator Gutula had added to it was his idea. I think the purpose was to actually be able to hire counselors for the rural areas of the state. And that would be approximately 10 to 12 to 15 counselors. And so certainly it could expand to that extent if indeed you use that money for counselors being added to those areas. And the idea behind the rural areas is that the Carl Perkins funding that has been used to fund the program has been basically addressing the needs of the students in the high schools that had large enrollments. Certainly we could use the money if the money did become available.
Yeah, as I understand the proposal, it's to really establish a model in which we will get more counselors somewhere between K through 12, and also then to provide additional training. What will this additional training be, classes or?
The model is actually in existence now and has been for 3 years within the state of Alaska. And the training has taken the form of workshops that counselors within the state attend on a 3 or 4 day basis, actually explaining the model to them. They then go back into their districts and implement that model.
Is this something that the school districts can use their in-service days to accomplish?
An idea behind some of the monies would be instead of actually school districts coming to one location, the counselors from a school district, that this money be provided for counselors who are already implementing the program to go out to those districts. And then, indeed, the school districts could use in-service days for the counselors to be in-serviced in this particular program. But, indeed, you would still need some funding for existing counselors to go in.
Are they given academic credit towards recertification?
Yes, they are. Yes. If they wish to apply for that, yes.
Well, in my opinion, that should be an incentive, and therefore maybe the fiscal note can be reduced a little.
They are. Through the University of Alaska Anchorage, I believe, or Fairbanks, this last time, they've given one credit for attendance if they wish to pay the money for that.
Further questions? Representative Brown?
Thank you. What will the people in the Department of Education be doing exactly?
I'm going to yield to my distinguished colleague from the Department of Education to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander.
Yes.
Peggy Callan, Department of Education.
Hi, thanks, and thank you, Drew. I am Peggy Cowan from the Department of Education. I am the acting administrator for the Office of Basic Education, and the counseling program is coordinated from this office. I'll respond first to your question and then give the department's position. The positions in the department right now, we have a full-time counseling position that is partially general fund and partially federal Carl Perkins vocational money. And then we have two part-time people who work on the program to assist the counselor in coordinating of it and to assist in the finance and the grants administration. The additional positions requested within the department would be, right now the grant program is at $100,000, so if the grant program went up to $150,000 or $500,000, even obviously at the lower fiscal note at $150,000, it would be doubling the amount of schools and the number of people involved. Those people that do coordination, the grants go to the school districts. The school districts support their own people in it, but the Alaska School Counseling Program is a comprehensive statewide program, and the people within the Department of Education coordinate the setting up of the trainings. They coordinate the training of the trainers. The cadre of trainers within that provide the training are both department staff and then teachers around the state, and so then they set up support for those folks. And so it would be a matter of the grants administration and then the additional burden of coordinating a program that would be about twice the size.
Yes,
go ahead.
That
The two part-time positions shown in the fiscal note, are those existing positions?
No, they're not. This is, again, an addition. Right now,
so you're asking, so you would have one full-time and four part-time people?
No, it would actually be an increase of what we, well, two things. And we're going to consolidate services. Right now, the program coordination is done out of my office, and the granting is done out of the Office of Vocational Ed. Next year, those are offices are being combined within the office, within the EPS, Educational Program Support. So we'll be doing some merging, but between the additional grants burden and between the additional coordination of in-services and travel and those kind of things, we're assuming it'll be about a third more of a person. And then the additional clerical support to support the paperwork that goes along with it. So we'd be basically probably, I hope, would be consolidating positions and focusing people rather than adding a new person. But the people who are already working with the program would be spending more of their time. Right now we have an education associate, too, who is spending about 25% of their time on the program.
What about, I guess it's hard for me to envision that many people administering a program that looks pretty straightforward. Just looking at the language in the bill, it doesn't look like there's any complicated
right.
criteria that one has to do to qualify. I'm just wondering why we need this level of staff support for coordination. It just seems like a lot of coordination and why aren't we getting the resources down into the schools?
Well, it takes this amount of coordination to get the resources to the school. Again, it's not simply a grant program where we hand out the money and then we step back. It's a statewide comprehensive school counseling program. There, as Drew described, there are a number of phases in it. It's with the new school districts, do a lot of technical assistance, helping them in terms of their evaluation and their, deciding and setting their vision for what they want to do, and then during the year of implementation, a lot of work, again, getting people out there. So it's a coordinated program. We don't just give the money to the districts and then let them run on their own. The counselor who is in charge of the program does a number of other duties. She doesn't just do this. She's in charge of the child abuse regulation and monitoring for the training regulation and monitoring for that. She's in charge of a variety of at-risk training programs that we do, works with the health in the health areas as well. So the counseling specialist, is not dedicated full-time to this position, but she is the overall coordinator of it.
Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, I got three questions here. First of all, your position paper is sort of like lukewarm. Why is that?
The department's position is neutral because of the additional funding burden to the state. The department supports the Alaska School Counseling Program. We're really actually very proud of it and feel that it has made a difference in the state and in a variety of school districts. We are not planning right now on reducing our own general fund support to the program in our budget projections and plans for reducing our program for next year. And in our current staff reductions, we didn't reduce any of the staff in this program, but because of the additional financial burden, we are neutral on the bill.
Okay, in this letter here from Senator Collins to Representative Mike Guevara, Carl Perkins Vocational Education Grants have been used to help fund the program, but only 22 school districts are eligible for these federal funds. Why just 22 instead of
Actually, it's a competitive fund, and so the 22. There are some that are eligible that are not participating. But the primary problem with it is you have to have a vocational ed program, an approved program, on the books in order to participate in this. So there's that's a screening because it's federal. And I am not the administrator for VOC Ed, so I'm not real. This is not my expertise. I'll definitely follow up and and give you something in response. But basically, the you have to have an approved program to participate in the Carol Perkins funds. And in this situation, it would be a counseling program. The funds are fairly limited. There are most of the districts that are participating are single sites or large districts where people can drive because of the limited funds. And again, the primary the funds that the districts are now getting are primarily for training, not for staff. SICA gets $5,000. Southwest Region gets $3,000. You know, it's they're around $5,000 to $8,000 for most of the districts, and most of that money goes into providing the training for the staff and the implementation of the new program. It doesn't go into personnel. It's fairly limited in funds.
If it sounds like it's a local government or a local school board decision, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So, yes, it is. It's nothing mandated.
So if this is a priority of that, would they not qualify for the Carl Perkins funds?
I'll have to double check. I don't. My understanding was it was more in terms of the limitation of funds available, and I'll have to find out, you know, why they wouldn't qualify. I can't speak to. I'm not sure about that. Again, I'm okay.
Well, I'd question the school boards if it's a real priority. It seems to me they'd go after these.
Well, there's only $100,000 within the Carl Perkins,
right.
And that's right now funding the you know the districts that are participating. So, and we don't want it. And it's an ongoing program, so there's no sense of sort of. Though actually, after they go through the cycle, then we could start some new programs. So we don't want to pull the rug out of the you
okay,
know the
you
programs
just stated
are going.
Some of them did not apply. Right?
Yes, and I'll have to find out.
Seems to me, if it was a priority, they would apply.
But some of them didn't receive them. And I'll have
that,
to double check.
But
I can't tell you how many districts that applied did not receive funds. I have to
well,
go back and
check. Well, it says 22 were eligible for federal funds.
Right.
Or are eligible for federal funds.
Right.
Okay, and then in this one more, third question here is in the letter it says decrease the fund, Department of Education to help finance a 4-year-old Alaska school counseling program. A model counseling program has been used in 16 of the 54. School districts. Are other school districts asking for this model? Or
yes, yeah, and we actually using some state funds and some district funds have been
Let me ask this: did all 54 ask for it, or just 16 out of the 54?
The 22, the 16 were the ones that were part of it last year. The 22 is new ones
okay,
for this year, and then we've gotten an increase request for this year's.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, I started out very much in support of this bill, and now I'm learning there's more bureaucracy in it, so I got to ask a question, I guess.
Okay.
We're talking about counselors, which first of all have gone through 4 years of undergraduate study, and then they've gone through a master's program and are generally very well educated. What is this training you're telling us about that, you know, they're incapable of doing their job now? What is this training that you're giving them that they need to do the job better?
It's a different approach to counseling. It's a comprehensive approach looking at a number of different service areas. I'm going to check my notes to make sure. But what part of the evaluation that Drew was talking about that happened in the first year is that students, the counselors review their own program, discover whether or not they're basically dealing with emergencies, providing services to all students. They evaluate in terms of the four program components. One is career, one is individual student planning, one is responsive student services, and then system support.
Shouldn't their principal be evaluating the counselor to see if the counselor is doing that? And if the counselor isn't, that
well,
maybe
except
they
for,
need to replace them?
Yes, except for, again, even with all the training and with the perception, this a perception of a lot of people's expectations is that they simply are dealing with the problems as opposed to providing comprehensive services and preventive services for all students. This gives them a sort of a new view on it and supports a comprehensive program. Comprehensive counseling programs are fairly new. This one's modeled after other strong ones in the lower 48. And so this is a new approach that even people with the training you're talking about haven't been engaged in or really thinking in terms of developing this kind of approach. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Alexander could probably, with has more counseling background than I do, could probably answer that if you'd like more details on it.
Yeah. Basically, the training then it has to deal with children at risk or health areas or child abuse, to recognize those things? Is that what we're talking
about? It's both recognizing those things and managing a whole program to reach all students in these four areas so that you're simply not putting out fires, but that so that you can develop a program that reaches the students that don't show, that aren't causing trouble at the moment either, but that but also makes you more effective in dealing with the at-risk students as well.
What special training does the teacher have who goes out to train the counselors? I mean, do they have a special degree?
Yeah, our counseling specialist who developed this program did have a special degree and has worked both within Alaska and the lower 48 in comprehensive school counseling programs. Unfortunately, she is not with the department anymore, we have not hired a new counseling specialist, and we'll do that with the new fiscal year, so I can't speak to the person, who isn't there. But one of the components of this program is to use both the expertise within the state and the expertise within the department to train a cadre of trainers. So it's not just the Department of Education. It's people like Mr. Alexander and other counselors from around the state that become part of the expert team who then have participated in the program and participated in the training and can train others down the line.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So what you're doing is training counselors to become more proactive rather than reactive, essentially.
Right.
What sort of, have you set up any program, any methodology for monitoring the program, and what sort of criteria have you developed to determine the success or...
There is ongoing evaluation, during the program, and then one of the things in the third phase, part of the a major component, the first phase again is looking at the program, looking at what you're doing, deciding what you really want to do, looking at what you can do. The second phase that Juno is now in is this implementation phase. The third phase includes a large evaluation component and review and revision, though there's formative evaluation going on all the way through.
What will you be looking at?
And that, unfortunately, I'll turn to Mr. Alexander. I have not directly been a part of this. I know the overview of the program. I don't know the exact criteria. Can you speak to that?
There's two chairs up there. You don't both have to go back and forth all the time.
I'll share it with you.
Again, my name is Drew Alexander. What we're looking for is an increased maintenance of the attendance and graduation rate of those students who enter their freshman year and graduate from high school, and that's the bottom line. I mean, that we want to keep them in school, and we want to, and by keeping them in school, that means that we're addressing so many of the needs, the social needs, as well as the educational, occupational needs of the child. This program, if I may go back to Representative Larson, so many of the programs, even today, that are turning out counselors are still in the reactive mode. You sit in your office and you wait for students to come with you with concerns, and then you try to address those concerns. The counseling program is proactive in that you deliver a counseling curriculum to all grade levels. You have to be in the classrooms. You're with the students, much as a teacher is today. And that's a large portion of it. And hopefully by addressing these concerns, the social aspect of it at an earlier age, then you can detour and maybe prevent some of these problems that students experience in their senior, junior years of high school.
Material uses the term curriculum-based counseling. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, just as English departments, PE departments, social studies departments have curriculum, there is a counseling curriculum that exists on dealing with interpersonal relationships with students, teachers, parents, and that's what is delivered. Self-esteem is a big issue. You must feel good about yourself in order to feel good about other people and being successful in school, and that's a large portion of the counseling curriculum itself. whenever possible, this should be integrated with existing curriculum in English and social studies, and that would be the ideal situation.
Representative Ullman.
I certainly support this program. Senator Collins and I have both served together on the Commission on Children and Youth and heard a lot of testimony on the need for it. I just have a couple of quick questions. Is the current version before us the original SB 394, or has there been a CS that isn't in my file?
I believe it's the current version. The fiscal note has changed, but the bill hasn't changed from last year.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question about the bill first. The department may make grants from the fund to eligible districts in the public school system. It does not tell us the basis upon which the department will decide which districts get it and which ones don't. I don't read any criteria in here, and I'm just wondering, is it going to be first come, first served, or what?
Okay, that's a good question, reasonable question. We haven't developed the criteria. We will obviously develop criteria. There has been some interest, and actually from different legislators, in terms of expanding the program to elementary as a need area, and that was also something that that was in the Gitche report. The other intent of the bill in all the discussions of it has been to reach the rural areas that are not being reached in the current legislation. Again, in my understanding, primarily because of the small amount of funds and the need for additional funds for travel. So those are two areas that have been targeted. The process to develop the criteria will be for the department to work with the School Counseling Association that Mr. Alexander represents and look at those need areas and have some consistency with the current Carol Perkins so that we are expanding that effort, not duplicating or supplanting or whatever it, but simply expanding it.
Okay, but there, we haven't any discussion on the Senate side of actually specifying some criteria in the legislation.
I have not heard of any particular. Okay. No, and again, I've only had individual conversations and individual phone calls from different legislators. There hasn't been anything.
It is not uncommon for the legislature to set out some criteria, even if it's of a vague notion for a grant fund like this, so that the legislature can express in a policy manner what the priorities are. And I guess I'm a little surprised not to see anything like that in here, because I don't think it makes sense to do it on a basis, and I don't know if the department's criteria would necessarily be the same as what the legislature would think of as being the most important. And I don't know if you have any suggestions to us about it. I haven't really given this a lot of thought, but it does seem rather open-ended at this point.
And it is open-ended, and we haven't been requested to provide criteria. We could certainly at this juncture, as I say, sort of jump the process and work with the Counseling Association and look again from the communication we've had and recommend some. But again, without the legislature recommending some to us, we've been dealing with a given.
If I may. Representative Ullman, it would be a nice problem to have if we did get the additional funding that was that the Senate Finance actually added to the bill, that we would be able to have on a competitive basis a number of elementary or secondary counseling positions that could be funded through the bill. The original intent of the bill was actually the spread of the program throughout the state, the $150,000, or even going for private funding to be able to do that in existing counseling programs. The existing counseling program in the state, 54 districts, to actually implement the program. And so the intent was not to actually for that to be competitive. It was to make it available to all 54 districts. If, indeed, we've got the additional funding for counselors, then certainly some guidelines would be drawn up to see who should be able to get those counselors. Is it the rural areas where no counselors even exist today? Is it areas where you have counselors and there are no certified counselors? And that's also, there's a teacher acting as a counselor in several of the areas. And so I certainly think that if there were additional funding added for counselors, that we would have to draw up some guidelines on who should get those funding.
Thank you.
I would like to make a correct statement. There are counselors in rural areas. When you say that there are none, that's incorrect. So what I'd like to point out is this curriculum is for training teachers. When they go through the normal process of getting trained in college, one of the things that I have problems with is that there is a huge fiscal note to this. And the other problem that I see is that this is money to train teachers, further train teachers in counseling. When the purpose of counseling is to provide services to students, and it seems like it's going a different direction.
Representative McLean, I in no way intended to mean that there are not counselors in rural areas. I know there are some rural areas that do not have counselors, but I've worked on the North Slope. And actually being a counselor at Barrow High School, I know that there are counselors and some well-qualified counselors there. The fiscal note that was attached, and it's actually to train counselors to implement the program. It's not to train teachers to implement the program. The counselors that are being educated today are still being educated in the universities in a very reactive mode. And the purpose of the program is to make them proactive and to be able to address the needs of the students before they get to be monumental problems that you see the suicides taking place or the drug abuse that's occurring. And so it's in a proactive approach that we're trying to get to the different districts and the counselors.
Okay, then my other question would be, when we have health curriculum within the classrooms, don't they address those suicide prevention, teen pregnancy? The health curriculum addresses those problems. And when you say, rather than reacting, to be proactive, what do you mean by being proactive? Because those are already subjects that are within the health curriculum that are taught in the classrooms.
That's correct. And at Geno Douglas High School, our health curriculum is the counseling curriculum. I mean, our health teacher, who is a certified counselor, delivers the counseling curriculum to the health classes through this program, through the Lasso School Counseling Program. And if you have a copy of the program there, it is a sequential curriculum. And in the ninth grade, what is being recommended by the program for the ninth grade students is being delivered to them through the health curriculum. And it's been a very valuable resource to our health teacher. By being proactive, what we're trying to do, in other words, instead of waiting for someone to come to us and a student to come to us and say, so-and-so is thinking of suicide, we want to get to that student. We want that the lifestyle of that student. We want the support of that student to be affected in a positive manner before it ever gets to the point that that child would think of suicide. And by delivering it in the health classes or by delivering it through the counseling curriculum, we're hopeful that it would never get to that point that we could see, you know, the teenage rate of suicide or the attempted suicide in our state.
Thank you.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm more than a little appalled. I'm appalled that you sit here and say that we have to train the counselors to be proactive and do these things, because I would like to know why in the world we hire them if they aren't trained and they aren't ready to be proactive and to work with these students, because they're not worth a dime a dozen if they're not trained to do those things.
Representative Barnes, I appreciate those comments, and I agree with you. If you were to go to the school districts today, the traditional high school counselor, and the traditional high school counselors that way, often because the school district sets roles for those counselors. Those counselors have clerical tasks. Those counselors are administering standardized tests. They're serving lunch duty. They are cleaning out lockers. And instead of being there for the students when they need them, they have many other tasks that are made responsible for. The school district has to become aware of what the counselor is supposed to do, and a part of this program is that. A counselor may be hired for a variety of reasons, but they're trying to get out there and be proactive, and this is a vehicle for that.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. If the school district don't know what they're hiring counselors for, something is wrong.
And the school district is hiring for the traditional counselor. And that's the intent of the program, to change the role of the counselor.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnes. Again, that's why there is something wrong, and that's why, though a lot of districts are well-meaning and a lot of districts have a very strong program, and again, the counselors out there are working very hard and trying to do meaningful work, and that's why the department established this comprehensive school counseling program to try to take care of some of the things that are wrong.
Representative Brown.
Has it been considered that an effective way to change the role of the traditional counselor would be through the university's education program, the program that actually trains people to be counselors? How does that fit in?
It does fit in. And Norm Geisberg, who is the consultant that has come up and actually developed this Alaska School Counseling Program with us, is the counselor or the professor of counseling at the University of Missouri in their counseling department. And it is the new counseling, the counselor today in many universities looks like the Alaska School Counseling Program.
How about the University of Alaska?
The University of Alaska itself has not, and this is to my knowledge, has not actually adopted the same curriculum the University of Missouri Counseling Program does. But it certainly should be.
I guess what I'm saying
right. We should be turning them out.
That if the root problem is the counselors are coming out not knowing what they need to know, why aren't we directing this legislation to change our own counseling program at the University of Alaska?
True.
Representative Kokanen.
Just commenting on this point, I think Dr. Larson would bear this out. One of the problems is really a matter of turf in schools, especially at the secondary level. There's great reluctance of teachers to allow anyone else in the classroom who is not under the authority of the teacher, though there's a rivalry of almost a possession of the student. And counselors have traditionally have been doing a lot of organizing of student schedules, helping schedule students, looking at their post-graduation career, you know, when to go to school, and or vocational orientation of the student. Again, reactive because they're expected to stay in their office. So I presume that part of the training program extends to training the principal of the school and the teachers as well. That's in how to work with a counselor in a collegial situation rather than in a very schools traditionally organized very much, especially secondary schools like Victorian factories, and everybody in his place doing his own particular part of the job, specialized part, and they without necessarily interacting.
Thank
so it's a structural problem in the districts as well as the training of the counselor, the teacher, the principal.
Thank you for bringing up that point, and we have been remiss in not saying that a part of being part of this program is requiring that the administration also be in the training as well to educate them on the role of a counselor.
Further discussion? Pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass Senate Bill number 394 from committee with individual recommendations with a fiscal note that would read $150,000 in the grants and claims line only.
Chairman, I think I'm going to have to oppose that one.
Fiscal note number one.
Modified.
Modified. It would only be $150,000 for grants, none of the other. Minus the 26.8 or 26.
Call for the vote.
Fiscal note number one. Okay, I see. So it would be just the grant line?
Yes.
Right. Just $150,000 in the grant line.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to oppose the bill for the time being because the testimony from the Department of Education that only 22 school districts have applied. I'd like to know why the others haven't and what the reasons were for the Colin Perkins monies. Until I get that answered, I'm not real satisfied with this bill. And I hate to do that for the prime sponsor, but, you know, the facts are the facts.
Representative McClain.
Yes, I don't know if I have the full answer to it, but I know that the Carl Perkins scholarships or the programs, the grant amounts
are for urban areas primarily.
Mm-hmm.
Rural areas don't...
Is there a law or something prohibiting the rural areas from applying? That's what I want to find out, Elaine. I want to know why they're not applying. If there's a law, then I can see.
There's a qualification on this. Again, I am not an expert on voc ed, and I apologize for the administrator of that unit not being here. There is a qualifying. The schools have to be 100 students. There's a qualifying clause in terms of the number of students in the school, and so I believe it's 100 students. And this is for the secondary. This is, again, the districts who are involved are primarily the single site and urban.
Okay,
any of the small ones
are... You said there's 22 school districts that applied, right?
Right, that received the funds.
So that's 22 out of 56.
Right.
And you're saying that if a school itself, a standing site, doesn't have 100 or more students, then they're ineligible for the funding, right?
Representative Phillips, that's my understanding, but again, I will follow up and give you information. I apologize, I don't have it now.
34 school districts that don't have a student body of 100 or more in one building?
Secondary also.
At the secondary level.
Right.
Wanda, do you want to...
Perhaps. I want, for the record, I'm Wanda Cooksey. I work for the School Counselors Association. My understanding is that number 22 has to do with schools that were not eligible to apply for Carl Perkins money. And it's not a matter of whether they've chosen to apply. There were some because of the criteria. Carl Perkins is federal money. The criteria just didn't reach some of them. So since the program has been set up so far totally with Carl Perkins money, put some general fund money in it would allow schools that were not eligible for the federal money to get help in another way. It was looking at a partnership. I hope that's helpful.
The objection maintained.
On the ultimate fiscal note will be dependent on the conference committee's, because I feel that if we want adequate monitoring of the program, we would need some funding, but I think that would be certainly the department would need some, but if the, given the wide gap that you have with the Senate bill, I think can see there's some room for maneuver. So, thank you.
Objection maintained. Without objection, the bill moves to committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note. The bill looks even better and better. Take up House Bill 484 and 486 at this time.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman,
484 and 486.
Oh, yes, this is the
Attorney General's office. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Mark Hanley, staff representative of Gruenberg. I'm also the staff for the settlement subcommittee. These two bills, HB 484 and 486, were introduced by the House Judiciary Committee at the request of the settlement subcommittee. Part of what the settlement subcommittee did was ask legislative legal counsel to look at the settlement that the governor agreed to in October and ask them to look at it in view of our state statutes and constitution and see if there was anything, any problems with the settlement as far as our state, especially our state's powers of appropriation or any existing state statute, and also to make suggestions to us as to what could be done to make the settlement work within our existing constitutional framework. The result of those that and the committee's deliberations were House Bill 484 and 486. 484 basically does three things. First of all, we recognize the trust, basically giving the legislature's blessing to the trust. Second of all, what we do is we basically put the trustees of the state